So, for today's Dhamma talk, this evening's Dhamma talk, as you all understand, there's so much that I have talked about over the years, and everything I say goes on YouTube. So in order to try and make things a little bit interesting and different as much as you possibly can, you always try and pick up, you know, recent events or things which have happened in my life recently, just how we can use these events to understand more about these Buddhist principles, Dhamma principles, ways that we can use these to have a more wise, peaceful, kind life. Many people talk about kindness and compassion, but sometimes that, you know, do you really understand what kindness, compassion truly is? You know, do you really understand what peace is? We're trying to make a more peaceful world. Why is it that always things that go pear-shaped and there's more problems and difficulties in some places? And why can't we just have this sense of tolerance towards one another? Why not? And one of the reasons is, you know, that instead of the theories, which we have the dogmas, what does Buddhism teach? Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Three Characteristics of Existence. You can read all of those in books if you want to find a theory. But sometimes how we can get that theory applied to our daily problems of life, that is what is really important. And of course, in the last week, in my life anyway, that people are telling me about the wonderful news, according to Buddhism, it's really just, we're right behind this, of the same-sex marriage, that is now approved. And you all probably have said this here before, that I've already done my blessing of same-sex marriage a long time ago, when I was in UK. So I've already done that. So I've been there, done that. But not here in Australia yet. So I'm sure that's going to happen soon. Our marriage celebrant Dennis over the back there, I'm sure that he's very open to being contacted. Anyone wants to? Because many people who come here feel they are welcomed, no matter just what race, religion, gender, anything. So it's not that we're desperate for more followers that anyone will accept. It's just that there's something just about the way I was taught, by someone like an Ajahn Chah, the way I practiced, which is, we don't sort of reject anything. In fact, you all probably know just how I've stood up for good causes. Actually, I haven't really stood up for good causes. I keep sitting down for good causes. So, for things which are going to assist the health, happiness, peace of everybody who lives in our world. And when we had the ordination of nuns, bhikkhunis, full ordination here, and then there was always some resistance there. And somebody sent me this beautiful poem, and it was that they drew a circle which shut me out. And it said, heretic, somebody different, someone to flout. But love and wisdom had the wit to win. We drew a circle which drew them all in. It was about the circles which we have in life, which these are the things we accept, and everything outside of that circle is what we reject. And once we have those circles, the things which we can tolerate, which we can accept, which we think are right, and we'll always have the things outside which we get angry about, which we reject. And there is a big problem when that happens. But as that little simile there was a great way of understanding what compassion is, we drew a bigger circle which accepts people in, not rejecting people. And sometimes you ask, why are people's circles so narrow? where we can only accept certain behavior, certain types of people, certain sort of situations. Why is it that we can't expand our circles wider and wider and wider? And of course, one of the things is the fear that if we allow this to happen, it's the thin end of the wedge. If we allow these things to occur, if I allow people to come into this hall and just to come in late, or to snore, or to make noises, it's going to go all wrong. If I turn off my mobile phone for the whole sort of 1 hour talk, who knows, somebody might be important who was trying to call me. I've got to sort of, there's a lot of fear which dominates our life. And it's that fear of what would happen if I widen my circle of what I can accept, what I can include in, what I don't need to fight in my life. And if one can widen that circle, you find most of the fear is totally unwarranted. Even like I was reading another article someone sent me on the weekend, is just how much we work and how we should all, including myself, work less and do less. But if we work less and do less, then we'll get, the economy will go down, everything will go wrong, I won't be able to pay off my mortgage, I won't be able to pay off this, pay off that. And they were just saying just how much people overwork and how little productivity that produces and how little sort of that increases our health and well-being. It's something which I'm sure you all recognize. You know, when people keep coming up to me, I feel stressed out. And I think I mentioned many times that I was shocked, but you know, afterwards realized just how I should have seen this before. I was told that at a youth conference, a youth seminar, which I did in Kuala Lumpur many, about 4 or 5 years ago, you know, someone had a very bright idea to ask, you know, the young people, 15 to 25, what was their most difficult emotion they faced in those years. You know, was it sort of, you know, like rejection? You know, was it like fear what other people thought of you? Was it, you know, the inability to live up to parents' expectations? You know, was it the fear of finding being popular with your own peer group and with others? And the one thing which came out from the 15 to 25 year olds, the most troubling emotion, they say, was tiredness. And I thought, even at 15 to 25, you're exhausted, you're tired. Why is that happening? Why are we working ourselves, working our children to the bone? Why are we working ourselves to the bone? Is that what life is really all about? And you know, on that subject, there was a couple of things happened. A person was on the retreat recently. They were a personal coach to many, many top managers, and they just were having a lot of success and being quite prominent. Many companies are running themselves. And they was writing a book. They wanted me to write a foreword to that book. Please don't ask me to write forewords. I can't even write forewords to my own books. But then I told them, why not? This is a story which, you know, is from one of my first books. I've opened the door of your heart. I said, why not sort of mention the story of the Mexican fisherman? And it's a beautiful little story. And again, it came up again in another little talk I gave over in Bodhinyana Monastery last week to someone who was a high flyer. And the Mexican fisherman's story just actually puts it into perspective of, you know, how silly and stupid we are. It was an American was on vacation in the Caribbean coast of Mexico when he was just walking early in the morning, he saw a fisherman come back from his morning voyage to sea, coming back to unload his catch of fish just before lunchtime. And the American on vacation said, "No, what are you doing?" And the Mexican fisherman said, "Well, I've caught enough fish this morning. Now I'm going to, after unloading my morning catch, I'm going to go back to have lunch with my wife. And after lunch with my wife, I'll have a siesta. And after the siesta, I'll be there at home in the afternoon when my children come back from school. I can just play with my kids, have a nice dinner with them, and in the evening I'll go to the canteen and play a little bit of guitar, have a few drinks with my friends, not too much. So life is good." And that the holidaymaker, the vacationer, said, "Señor, that's a waste of a resource. Your fishing boat is sitting idle all afternoon. Why don't you have some lunch and go out in the afternoon. Don't be so lazy. And then in the afternoon you'll be able to catch twice as many fish. And with that extra profit, after a few months, you'll be able to buy a much bigger boat with a crew. And then you'll be able to catch so many fish with the extra profits after another year or two, you'll be able to buy another boat. After a few years, you'll be the owner of a big fleet of fishing boats. And with all the money you make out of that, you can move your business to Mexico City, do an IPO, which award yourself many share options, and then you can do a company buyback. I don't know what on earth I'm talking about, but it works something like that. And you'll soon be a multimillionaire." That's how it's done. Free advice, because I'm a professor in the business school in the U.S. And at that, the Mexican fisherman said, "But, Señor, then what would I do with all those millions of dollars?" And the professor replied, "Well, then you'll be able to retire. You'll be able to retire to a nice little fishing village like this. You'll be able to buy yourself a little boat just for fun in the morning time. You always have be able to have lunch." Lunch with your wife, and always have a nice snooze in the afternoon, and be there for your children in the evening, and you'll be so sort of stress free. You can go and have go to the cantina in the evening for some fun and games with your friends. "But, Señor, I do that already." And I love that little story, because why is it that people just stress out too much? Because they're trying to live like poor people. What are you doing that for? And sometimes it's like the fear that if I don't do that, I don't do what other people do, that, I'm going to miss out on, I don't know, what you're missing out on? The fear of missing out. So why don't you have a look at your Buddhist monks and nuns? I've missed out on so much of life. And I'm very glad I missed out on a lot of stress. I missed out on divorces. I missed out of kids waking me up in the middle of the night. I missed out on bosses from hell. I missed... So look, what have you missed out on? Have you missed out on some peace? And some freedom, and some ability just to enjoy the beauty of life. It's all out there for you. What more do you want? And as sometimes this is one of the things that always drives me just to stop. I use that word quite carefully, to drive you to stop. Because we're always going so fast in this life that we miss so much. And just these old anecdotes come up about the story when I was over in Bodhinyana Monastery down at Serpentine over 7 years before I had the opportunity of walking up the hill in the place where I live. And 7 years been up and down that road, Kingsbury Drive, in a car. And the first time, you know, I had plenty of times, a beautiful spring morning, and I asked the driver, please let me out. It's very difficult these days to get let out from a car. They say, no, 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 we'll drive you. But I want to walk. No, 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 you're missing the opportunity to give me some good karma. Please let me do it for you. So, you know, sometimes it's very hard to just to walk. Now, one time it's amazing, this monk, years ago, he arrived at Perth Airport, and I said, well, let me know when your plane touches down, I can arrange a lift. He said, no, I'm not going to arrange a lift. I just could see what happens if I arrive at an airport and no one picks me up. So, you know, monks don't have any money, we don't have credit cards, you know, we're totally stuck. But we've got 2 feet, so he started walking from Perth Airport. He only got about 50 metres when a car stopped. And he said, oh, you're a Buddhist monk? Yeah. I said, where are you going? To monastery. He said, I'll give you a lift. And, you know, it's much better than Uber. It's a good karma. And he just went there. There was another monk years ago that, you know, he was a good old friend, a Japanese monk. His name was actually Shibahashi, but Anakanchar could not pronounce it, and so called him Sibat Hasip. In Thai, that means $4.50. And that became his nickname, Sibat Hasip. But what he did, he was going to visit his family in the north of Japan, so he got the ride to Tokyo on the aircraft, but when he got to Tokyo, he just got out of the aircraft and started walking. And he walked. And then, wherever he got to, he just put up his little Thai forest monk mosquito umbrella and just camped there. And within a day or two, the Japanese news crew found him. And he became a celebrity. You know, a real monk. And after that, that was where the Thai ambassador to Japan at the time, you know, that she found him and said, alas, is a really good monk. You know, someone who is living simply. And she was actually the ambassador to Australia, Suchitra Hiranyapuk. And so she came here many years afterwards. And she was here, I think Sol knows her, because that's the time we had our 30th anniversary. She came and witnessed the amazing things which are happening here. So sometimes, you know, no fear. It's amazing just how when you don't have any fear, things tend to come out just the right way. And instead of always going, oh, I just have to get some money just in case, I have to have some security. Security, I have actually got no security at all. If you look at our Buddhist Society, West Australia Constitution, I'm only the abbot because the monks haven't read that constitution. And they will find out, they can vote me out any day. And I've got no investments, no security, no recourse. So, you know, sometimes it's great when you have that sort of that confidence. Just live in the present moment, trust your good karma, trust your kindness, and have no fear. And when the monks first went to Ajahn Chah's forest monks, the first place they went to, you know, was to England. And I remember I was there when they had this conversation. They said, you know, to Ajahn Chah, well, we go there, what if people don't feed us? And Ajahn Chah said, aren't there kind people in London? And it's a beautiful answer. Of course there's kind people there. Aren't there kind people in Perth? Of course there's kind people in Perth. So what have you got to worry about? There are so many kind people that when you see just these wonderful, wonderful acts of kindness in ordinary people, you realize that is your insurance. There's always going to be someone who's going to look after you, you know, when things go really, really difficult. Maybe not the government, but people. And it's wonderful, you know, wonderful to see that, just the beauty, the kindness in this our society. I just remember just, you know, little anecdotes which come up. There was this one story I saw in the Western Australian, because people actually, great stories, they cut them out and give them to me. And there was a child in the southern suburbs, maybe 7, 8, 9 years of age. You know, for his Christmas present, he got a new BMX bike. And he was just riding back from school one day, and he saw two other boys that were older than him by maybe a couple of years. And they'd caught a rabbit, and they were torturing this rabbit. And, you know, the younger kid stopped, and, you know, he was so appalled, had so much kindness, and said, "Stop doing that." And they just told him to please depart, but not in those words. And the younger boy couldn't fight, but he offered a deal for the rabbit. He said, "You can have my new BMX bike if you give me that rabbit." And, you know, a BMX bike is a lot of money. And a rabbit, you know, is not that expensive. And so they thought this little kid was crazy, but they did the deal. So the boy came home with a little rabbit, but no bike. And of course his mother and father asked him, "What's happened to your bike?" And when he told the story, they were so impressed with this little child's kindness. The father knew someone who worked in the West Australian. A great, nice, you know, good story. And it was on the front page. That's where they gave it to me. Just how beautiful kindness. A little boy would actually give up his bike to save us poor little rabbit. Great act of generosity and compassion and goodness. So the next day, I got another copy of the Western Australian, and the boy was on the front page again with 3 BMX bikes. People were so impressed. So impressed that what they did, they said they donated more bikes to that sort of that kid. And I thought, what a beautiful ending to that little story. Just they were so kind, the goodness that, you know, there are such beautiful, kind, good people in this world. And that is insurance policy for our world. So don't have any fear about what happens, because there's sometimes that, yeah, I mean, it's really worthwhile just letting go of the fear and making goodness and kindness the currency of our world. As I remember that, also an Ajahn Chah story, which is just things come up. Ajahn Chah predicted a long time ago that, you know, soon this world will run out of paper, so we won't be able to use paper for banknotes, and even plastic will run out of oil, and we'll run out of metal for the coins, so we'll have to find something else to use as world currency. And so Ajahn Chah said, "I think in the future what they will use for currency is these little pellets of chicken poo." And people will be so proud of how much chicken poo they earn every year. And they'll be going to their boss asking for an advance on, "Please, more chicken poo." You know these little pellets of chicken dung? And the chicken shit? And so, and they'd be fighting on who earns the most chicken shit. And they will actually be able to go to these ATMs where you put in a card and a whole lot of chicken shit comes out. And the IMF will become the International Manure Fund. And Western Australia will be so upset that most of the chicken shit on their GST goes off to these. Or whatever. I mean, what's the difference between money and just little pellets of chicken shit? Just the, you know, what actually value you give to it, that's all. And so it's just all that that conventional reality of just what we put value in and what we take value away from. And so sometimes that the fear of not having enough. I never saw that when, you know, in the olden days, and still this happens, when we had this wonderful sense of community. and families which didn't argue with one another, but which actually supported one another. A world where people would trust one another. And that world where people trust one another, that sometimes that people say, oh, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you're just living in cloud cuckoo land, it's okay in a monastery, but in the world, how can you trust one another? You know, a lot of time it's because we fear one another, that we don't even allow trust to grow. And that trust, you know, to build up in a community, in a family. And it was great, you know, when you had examples where, yes, you know, sometimes people did make mistakes, but they did not punish you by taking away the trust. They say, well, try better next time. To encourage trust as a commodity which is so important. Because if you don't have that trust, you have fear and fear control, and a lot of times that's where the stress comes from. In that little, little paper which I downloaded from the BBC website, you know, on just learn how to do less. Because if you learn how to do less and go slower, you find just how much more happiness, peace and productivity, and how much you've been missing out on life by rushing too fast. And that gets back to the story where I just went off on a tangent of Kingsbury Drive. First time walking up that road, and I just thought I was going up a different road, simply because I started seeing things I'd never seen before. Just because I was going slower. And then it was such a strange experience that I decided I had to just stop and stare. When you stop and stare, you don't move. What you saw was so much more and so much more beautiful. I saw little rocks which I'd never seen before, the lichen on the rocks. There was actually a little stream which was running in the valley, but I'd never seen that before. And the longer I looked, the more I saw, and the more I saw, the more beautiful it became. And it was such a weird experience for me that I started contemplating it afterwards. This is what we mean by the insight, by the emotional growth of a human being. It's not got from books, it's got from actually feeling and experimenting. And just life is always showing you just where that happiness and peace and health actually live. But this was experiences which come in your life, you contemplate it, why is this so strange? And you find out the reason why. Simple thing. It's just the anatomy of the eye, that when you look at a sight, the chemical reaction on the back of your eye on the retina, for most people doesn't have a chance to fully form. The process comes up, pushes away the last, and you have to deal with something new, and then something new, and then something new, and then something new. No image is fully formed when you're looking through the window of a speeding car. You get out of the car and you walk, your eye has more time to form a proper image, a more full image. You see more, literally, because the image has more time. And nothing beats just standing still and staring. Only when I stood perfectly still had the image in the back of my eye all the time it needed to form. And that's when I saw so much on that hillside which I've been passing for 7 years. And everything there looked more beautiful than I could ever remember. All the colours, instead of being pastel, washed out, were all rich. Greens and browns and greys, more rich than I'd ever seen before. Simply because I gave them time to be able to develop, and I could see them all. And to me that showed just how much happiness and joy comes when we don't chase things, or when we stop and let those things come to us. Now, people look at happiness, fulfillment, worth in their lives, but we go so fast that we're dead before we even realize just how much time we have wasted chasing and running and going too fast. And it's one of the things, even this little article, they said the benefits of working less and being idle, spending time doing nothing. The art of just being rather than going or developing. And it's one of the reasons why, please excuse me, but when anybody ever says they're trying to improve themselves, I think, oh my goodness, who told you you're not good enough already? Why do you want to improve? Because sometimes that improvement, who are you trying to please? You're just like the Mexican fisherman following somebody's advice. You know, just get more money. Go out in the afternoon and catch more fish. He said, why? You know, just having all that extra money, what do I need that for? I was like this fellow said, and he was the head of the manager of Changi Airport in Singapore at a conference I was at. He said, just when you earn so much money, you can't spend it. It all just goes to the government or to investments or to your kids or whatever. Now, after a while, just how much more do you really need? So after a while, we learn how to be simple and appreciate this moment. You know, the free happinesses, the free joys. Because then we realize that happiness is not in things. It is in people, relationships. So how we enjoy one another's company, the happiness, the relationship which we have, you know, with where we are and what we're doing. Sometimes this place, could we improve it? Yeah. But isn't it good enough already? Sometimes, oh yeah, we know we'd just improve it from every now and again, but sometimes this whole idea of improving, getting it bigger, getting it better, sometimes there's something which seems to me a little bit wrong. That's why I gave a talk to the monks on Wednesday night, as I usually do over there, and I was saying, if any of you go to Bodhinyana Monastery to take food there, go for a visit, you will find that there's many tiles missing in the entrance gate. There's lots of holes there, because we had a gate crasher, literally, a bus was too high and it just crashed into the gate, and some tiles are missing there. And when I was telling them, just when are we going to fix it up? Maybe we'll never fix it up. Maybe we'll leave it like that. Maybe we'll show that, you know, you don't have to be perfect. You can have actually things which are imperfect there. You can have a gate with many tiles missing. It's not dangerous, but it's interesting. It's not the same as other monasteries or temples. When something gets missing, you have to keep fixing it up and paying lots of money for it. Why not leave it like that? It was an interesting sort of idea of letting it show that this is our life. This is where, yeah, we do make mistakes, we do get sick, things go wrong. But why not accepting that? That is not really the problem. The problem is actually how we relate to that. How we actually reject that as something is wrong and needs to be fixed up, instead of just making peace with it. What will happen anyway? You fix it up and something else will go wrong with it, and just a North Korean missile will slam into it or something. So sometimes I just wonder, what are we just working so hard for and worrying and arguing so much about? Now, can't we just realize the most important part of a monastery, or of this place, or of life, is not things, but the people. When I first came over here, we first got that place for Bodhinyana Monastery, people would come and say, where's the monastery? We didn't have any buildings then. So where's the monastery? So we're talking about, this is the monastery. Well, there's no buildings. Yeah, buildings aren't monasteries. The walls and roofs aren't the temples. What's important is the people who come there. You are Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. You are. Not sort of the reception area or the Buddha statues. You are. This is sometimes people miss exactly what's really important in life. The other thing which I was going to talk about, which maybe you haven't heard or seen this, but for the Buddhism in Australia, we had a lot of conversation about an exhibit in the National Gallery of Victoria. A big a reclining Buddha statue, which was made by a Chinese artist. It's huge. And on the top of it, pouring on the top of it, is images of Greek statues. Now, Aphrodite, I know, is one of them, the god of love. I don't know who else is on there. But many Buddhists, you know, were saying, we should do something about this. This is disrespectful to the Buddha. But, you know, some of the leaders, including myself, you know, we said, hang on. You can't disrespect what the Buddha stood for. You know, you can protest, but is that really what the Buddha taught? Now, isn't it the most important thing, the reason why that Buddha statue was there in the first place, to remind us of, you know, virtue, peace and compassion, what I was saying last week? And I sort of came back and somebody reminded me of the old story of, you know, when the US Marines in Guantanamo Bay were accused of taking a copy of the Muslim holy book, the Quran, and flushing it down the toilet. And when they asked me, US Marines, but when the Australian newspaper rang up and said, what would you do if someone took a Buddhist holy book, flushed it down your toilet? And you all know the answer. I said, I'd call a plumber because I need to use that toilet. And after the laughter from the journalist, then I sort of was more serious. And I said that you can flush a Buddhist book down the toilet. You can blow up Buddhist statues, as they did just in Bamiyan. You can even burn down Buddhist temples. You know, you can kill monks and nuns. But I will never ever allow you to flush Buddhism down the toilet. Forgiveness, compassion, tolerance. And it reminded me of, and I was saying this on the internet and on telephone calls with some of the people who are wanting the Buddhists to react, you know, to what they thought was disrespect to a Buddha statue. Just reminding them that many, many, many years ago, when the British were still in India, in the holiest place of Buddhism, which was the Mahabodhi temple, where the Buddha got enlightened, there's no doubt that that was a historic event and that was the place it happened. And a couple of monks, they weren't even allowed to go in there because it was owned by the landowner in the area. I think it was called Mahant. But anyway, two monks from Sri Lanka went in there. And they stayed, you know, in the Mahabodhi temple. And they refused to get out. They said, well, this is our holiest shrine. And so one evening, some thugs sort of beat up those two monks so badly that they were both hospitalized. And when the police went to them to say, you know, please can you say what happened and, you know, who did it? And the monks refused to lay any charges. The monks refused to even identify the people who beat them up so severely. And the next day there was an article, you know, in the national newspaper of India saying just how wonderful it was that those monks actually practiced their religion with forgiveness and compassion. And that was the start of the access which we now enjoy to that Mahabodhi temple. Just the high-mindedness. The sometimes people think, oh, you're just being idealistic. There needs to be more idealism in this world, because just pragmatism sometimes, we've had enough of that and it's not working. The idealism which inspires and motivates people to a higher purpose and to a higher trust amongst one another, sometimes it's amazing just how, you know, I've seen that in my life anyway, how that works. And it is a beacon of hope to our world. So sometimes that when these things happen, instead of protesting, we'll say, no, you can never desecrate forgiveness and respect to what the Buddha actually taught. It's not the contents. It's not the container, it's the contents. It's what is inside those books. What's inside, what that image is supposed to represent. And that is the most important thing in our world. Just the contents, not the containers. And so this is actually where we can build some peace and harmony in our world. Now, if we can understand that, you know, these things are not in just what we have, but how they're used and how we relate to them. It's not just the money in the bank, but it's how it's used. You know, it's not being dominated by these things, you know, but you make use of them. The mobile devices, that we make use of them rather than owning us. The monastery temples are people, not things. That, you know, families, you know, they're not objects. You know, they're people who share our blood and share our history and share so much. And so if we can learn how to respect and live with those things, it's amazing what a peaceful world we have, and that we don't have to spend so much time fixing up the problems of life. Yeah, there's disagreements. Yeah, there are disappointments. Yeah, there's sicknesses. Yeah, there's things sometimes go wrong. As I was saying, you don't always get a good meditation. But it's the ones which don't work is where we learn how to expand that circle. To expand the circle of what we can expect, what we want, what should be, and to bring more and more things in. And bringing more and more of those things inside our circle is called expanding our compassion, our area. It's not just may all beings be happy and well, but may all situations be happy and well. May all differences be included into our circle. In other words, it's not what we experience is the problem in life. It's not who we have to be with is the problem in life. It's not just our plans and our disappointments which is the problem in life. The problem in life is just fighting, is rejecting, is just pushing things out. It is being afraid of some things which we don't understand. Bring them inside. Expand the circle of love, kindness, compassion, until it seems maybe you can include the whole universe. All beings, all situations. People say, that's being negligent. And I say, no, give it a chance. See what happens. The world doesn't stop when you don't answer your mobile phone for the weekend. The world doesn't stop or go all haywire if we forgive. You find that sometimes people live up to that trust when we forgive one another. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. So anyway, that's me going on. I decided I would only do a 3/4 of an hour today instead of going on and on and on and on. So anyway, that's a little talk about expanding our circle to let more and more people in, differences in. And also, situations, allow them to come in rather than always to have them outside. Thank you for listening. Okay, any questions from here, first of all? From the floor. Yes. It's a point about meditation, get to the point where you're almost asleep, but not really. And the point of meditation is not to get anywhere, to be where you already are. Stop going places. Instead, being here. It's just an old story. When I go traveling, Very rare to see human beings. Human goings, yes. Human beings, no. Have a look this weekend, over Christmas. Has anyone asked you where you're going for Christmas? You're nowhere. And that's, you're such a loser going nowhere. Nowhere's a great place to be. No nowhere. If you re-spell it, it means now, here. That was in a cryptic crossword in the West Australian last week. Nowhere is now, here. Exactly. This is the only place to be. So, even in meditation, it's also expanding the circle to allow this moment to be. You've got aching legs. It shouldn't be like this. It's too hot. We should have air conditioner. It's too noisy. Shouldn't allow people to make all this noise. Expand the circle. Allow more things in. And then you find you're at peace. You've nothing to do. So if you're sleepy, fine. If you're not sleepy, fine. The point is just being here. Being now, being here. Put them together. Nowhere. Okay. Okay, got some questions from overseas. Maybe. Here we go. How do I help with another feeling bereavement? My auntie and uncle lost their youngest child to a brain tumour and they hold such despair over this. Well, you're right, Fantine, that's all you can see, the loss of your youngest child to a brain tumour. But it's not a loss. You had that child for don't know how many years. And sometimes it's a bit tough, but I've only got a few, a minute or two to answer each one of these questions. And sometimes, would you rather never have that child come into your life at all? It's a tough question. I said, of course not. You know, it's wonderful we had them. We just wanted them longer. But you had them for such a long time already. You learned so much from them. You learned what real love is. And love is not possessing a person. Love is actually enjoying the time you have together and learning how to let them go. And you had to have that thing about letting go. Feeling bereavement is focusing on what's been taken away from you. And instead, gratitude, love, is appreciating what you've had. Wonderful. Thank you for being there for such a long time. Maybe not as long as you wanted. Not as long as you expected. But you've had something there. It's sometimes our language. I'm sorry about your loss. Say, no. You're so lucky to have had that person for such a long time. It's only 4, 5, 6 years. That was a wonderful time you shared together. You can never, ever expect people to be there forever and ever and ever. So the length of time is always going to be uncertain. It's not that important. The quality of that time, that is important. Anyway, I have social anxiety, and often it manifests as pain in the body, making me focus on it, creating escalating vicious circle, increasing the suffering and pain. I'm often afraid to go outside because of this, avoiding the subway. How do I get rid of this psychosomatic pain? Okay, that's that anxiety. And there's a story which I've said many times. It's in one of my books. And it is the story of when you have panic attacks, anxiety, especially social anxiety, it does manifest in your body. And please focus on it, but it's not just being mindful. Just being mindful is not enough. Add the kindness, just like that dentist when she was in Adelaide University studying dentistry. Her anxiety was focused in her chest. A story, just summarizing it briefly, I told her to start massaging that area. Massage it with as much kindness as possible. So she had the anxiety focus there, kindness. And she had this live-in boyfriend And I told her, if you feel too weak to do it, get your boyfriend to do it. I'm sure he will say, okay. That's what boyfriends are like. And the so she did that, and you know, it worked. The physical pain went away. And I always remember that time when, because she was in Adelaide, I was in Perth, and she had to keep ringing me every 2 or 3 days. And then I said, well, did you follow the instructions? Yeah. I said, what happened when you were massaging your chest area? I said, well, actually, the physical pain, the pain in the body just got less, and it vanished. And that's when I asked her, what happened to the anxiety? And that's when she said, that went too. And she got it. That's how you overcome that anxiety. And there's a doctor in this room here who told me, I won't say who she is because I get in trouble, that she told me that she had one of her patients with chronic anxiety, and one of her patients giving her all the different medications and nothing was working. And so I think before she went home one evening, she sort of said, oh, let's try John Barnes' method. And told her just to, next time you have a panic attack, just find that part of the body and just massage it. And she said to me the next day when she went to the ward, the patient had the mask off. And she said, I feel great now, going home. And it was a wonderful thing that doctor did. I scolded her a little bit, said, why didn't you do that from the start? I got in trouble from the doctor if I did that. So, but it works. You know, it's you have social anxiety or anxiety for about anything. Notice it as a pain in the body, that you've done the first thing there from Norway, you notice the pain. Mindful of that, now add the compassion. Just massage it until the physical pain just disappears. And then once that disappears, the anxiety goes with it. So, kindness. Yeah, sometimes you want it to go away, you're afraid of it, it gets worse. Find out just a compassion, a kindness. Like, physical massage is great. It just goes away. Even I'm doing this now because I haven't got no anxiety, but it feels good. And the last part of that story with that sort of dentist and her boyfriend, eventually they got married, and I did the service for them in Sunken Gardens in UWA. I'm so proud of that, that they got a couple who actually, she was just bedridden, and they respected me so much. Dennis, where's Dennis gone? Yeah, there. Remember doing that service in Sunken Gardens? It was really beautiful. So anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, my family in India is upset that I find time for Buddhist meditation but not for Hindu prayers. Practices lead to many arguments. What is the compassionate responses? Well, don't call it Buddhist meditation. Just call it meditation. Just, change the names, because that's sometimes what we do. For example, that when it came to Christmas time in Thailand, we asked our Ajahn Chah, said, what should we do? Because this is like almost like a festival. It's almost in our blood. We're all Buddhists. And he said, I'll just call it Chris Buddhamus. So we celebrate every year Chris Buddhamus. And even now, some will get a tree, not a sort of fir tree, didn't have fir trees, get a tree from somewhere, and Ajahn Chah would come along for the day. And he said, well, what's Chris Buddhamus all about anyway? And he says, it's about kindness and generosity. So, I can't see anything wrong with that. So there was the wise tolerance of a great master, just there, Chris Buddhamus. So, you call it Budindu meditation for Hindu, or Hindu Buddhist meditation. So sometimes that we can explain that what's the difference anyway? Even the Buddha was from India, so this is actually getting even closer. So we're meditating to actually so we can prepare our minds for the Hindu prayers. May all beings be peaceful and well. What's wrong with that? I don't know what else you can do there. But anyway, there's so many. So do the Hindu prayers. You can tell your parents or family in India, your prayers are, may all my family in India be Buddhists. May all my That's not going to be very good, is it? But no, it's a lot of times if people really do know their religious path, then they realize the most important thing is not just who's right and who's wrong, but that we can live in peace and harmony together. And to be able to do that, Buddhist meditation, well, maybe don't call it Buddhist meditation, just call it meditation. Change the name. And there we go. Change the name, and sometimes that it creates a little bit more peace and harmony. I think I told those stories last week. So, what is a compassionate response? So this is, you know, Buddhist meditation is like another form of Hindu prayer. Very deep one, very powerful one. Try that one. Anyway, if not, never mind. You find time for Buddhist meditation, for Hindu prayers. Do the Hindu prayers very quickly. So you can find time for that and time for Buddhist meditation as well. Because sometimes your parents and family are very important. So if you can find some sort of compromise there, that'd be wonderful. Anyway, there we go for this evening. So hopefully you enjoyed the session this evening. And there's another one coming Saturday afternoon meditation, Sunday Sutta class, more formal. Next Friday, another Friday night talk. Da da da. Okay, so now we'll pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then you can do whatever you need to do. Oops. Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantak Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.